1906.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscawain. We're talking about zoos today. Later in the program, we'll get into some of the challenges zoos around the world face. But first, we're going to focus on the Philadelphia Zoo and an interesting project underway there. The zoo just opened an expanded trail system. It goes through the treetops above visitors' heads. And that means if you look up, there could be a tiger staring back down at you. Joining us is Andy Baker. He's Chief Operating Officer at the Philadelphia Zoo. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, Jeff. Good morning.
So this is all part of this expanded trail is called the Big Cat Crossing, I guess is what the zoo calls it. And it's part of something called Zoo 360. Can you tell me a little bit more about what is Zoo 360?
Sure. Zoo 360, the general concept is creating a trail system for animals to use to travel around the zoo and on a timeshare basis use each other's enclosures and have an opportunity for a long-distance exploration.
Okay, and this specific portion that's just been expanded is called the Big Cat Crossing. What does that look like? Let's try to paint a picture in people's heads.
So imagine... That's such a visual concept. I really invite people to come.
Welcome to my world.
put in a plug for people to come see the tigers and come see the zoo. But imagine a mesh enclosed passageway that the tigers use, and in fact, all of our big cats will use to leave the footprint of First Niagara Big Cat Falls. Go overhead across the visitor pathway and then end up back on the ground right next to our bird lake.
And as a visitor, am I getting closer to these animals?
You know, I think if you were to take out a tape measure, you might not actually be closer than any other opportunity we already have, but it's a very different perspective, both, I think, for our visitors and for our cats. The whole concept of our trail system is really focused on animal well-being, and I can talk a little bit more about that. This gives them a new perspective on visitors and on the entire campus. From kind of the peak of their bridge on Big Cat Crossing, they've got a great vista, and they can see nearby exhibits and get a real sense of much greater visual neighborhood. And so for them, it's a new perspective, and for visitors, you're seeing cats in a very different way. I think we've all been struck really at a gut level. You really see the majesty of these cats. I frankly think you get the picture of them as these are predators much more instinctively than you do in a traditional zoo setting. And so you're not closer, but it's a very different and very engaging perspective.
And so we've sort of lumped them all into big cat category here. What kind of animals are we talking about here?
So we've got a number of species of big cat at Big Cat Falls. It includes our Amur tigers, African lions, Amur leopards, snow leopards, jaguars, and pumas. The whole concept of Zoo 360 and each of our trail systems is that it can be used by a variety of species. And so all of our big cats will get their opportunity to explore the system. Our two young Amur tigers are the first ones to try it out, and they have been incredibly interested in it, both of them, right from day one, immediately took to it. Seem to be enjoying the view from the top of the bridge where they've got this great perspective across the campus, and also enjoying going down near Bird Lake and seem very engaged in watching the swan boats move around the lake. But we'll be moving on to the other cats and give all the cats a chance to use the system. And so eventually we see all of our individuals having that opportunity to move outside of their usual habitats.
And how do you change from one animal to the next? Is that just sort of like opening gates and bringing a different one in, or is it more complicated than that?
Well, on one level, it's as simple as you just described. The system is set up so that different cats can access through different portals. Our keepers have great relationships with the animals, and they tend to sort of track what the keepers are doing, and the keepers are successful at moving cats back and forth when they want to. And so on that level, it's simple. On another, of course, it is complicated, and to some extent, it's a little bit like air traffic control, and you've got to make sure that you're communicating well and tracking what's going on. So it's a much more flexible from day to day, which makes it exciting for the animals, exciting for the staff, and really exciting for visitors.
And so when a new animal comes in, are they there for days or hours, or how does that work?
So we play it a little bit by ear. As more animals have an opportunity, it becomes sort of each day you might switch animals out twice or more times a day. So the different animals have an opportunity to use it at different times of the day. And you switch it up. We've got different parts of the trail system that can actually be segregated from each other. And so you can give one set of cats access to one part of the system and another set of cats access to another part. So we'll really play around with this and see what works best for the animals, but it gives us a tremendous amount of flexibility.
So part of this is about the visitor experience, but also part of it is supposed to be about the animals and animal welfare. How is this better for the animals in your zoo?
Yeah, so that's really what drove this. Of course, we want to make sure that engages our visitors and makes them feel a part and engaged with the animal collection. We hope that really prepares them to be champions themselves for preservation of wildlife and habitats. But this really came out of our goal of creating best experiences for animals. And I truly think that this reinvents the way animals experience our zoo. And so we've got animals now that are traveling close to, I'll go back, and of course, Big Cat Crossing is our fourth project as part of Zoo 360. We've done two pieces of trail system for our smaller primates, so our monkeys and lemurs. We did a Pilot 8 project connected to our outdoor orangutan habitat. And so we've got a number of animals, mostly, of course, primates and cats so far, really traveling significant distances. And what this does, it gives them just such a much greater variety in their sensory experience, opportunities for travel, opportunities for, if they're a group living species, they can spread apart if they want to, clump together. You can pick up your food one place and go eat it another. All this behavioral flexibility they have and environmental stimulation that is challenging to provide in a more traditional setting.
And so when the animals are in there, do they behave differently?
Well, in some ways, yes. And so some of the things I talked about, they're able to do in our trail system where they've got real choice about where they move to and what they engage with. And so we do see with some species, some of our territorial primate species, for example, we're seeing territorial calling start to emerge that we'd never heard in their home enclosures, like our Bolivian great teddy monkeys. They've got these fluffy, soft, teddy bear-looking little monkeys have this great, loud territorial call, and so we're starting to hear that. We see animals really running high-speed, long distance, which is, of course, challenging for them to do in a traditional exhibit. And we see them engaging with things they want to engage with, move toward that, and move away from things that they'd rather not be near. So that same group, the teddy monkeys, for example, their trail takes them over the giant tortoise exhibit. And the first time they saw the giant tortoises, they wanted nothing to do with those giant tortoises. But over time, they sort of got used to that. And so that kind of opportunity to confront environmental challenges but deal with them in your own at your own speed and in your own way is something that we think this trail system brings.
So are you trying to sort of create what that kind of animal would experience in the wild? Is there is there some science that says that this is going to be more like what this animal would experience in the wild? Or are you just sort of trying to mimic some of the things they might experience in the wild?
That's a great question. We're not truly trying to recreate the wild, but what we're trying to do is create the environmental opportunities, so the opportunities for new sensory input, exploration, freedom of locomotion, so capturing some of the same functional needs and functional opportunities that animals have in the wild without trying to recreate the actual natural habitat. In some ways, one of the things that's cool about this, if you look at how animals use their space in the wild, so say an animal has a, I'm just going to make this up, a group has a home range of 2 acres. Well, they don't use all of that 2 acres. They actually use key resource spots and the travel routes between it. And so we've really recreated that opportunity with these travel routes and then resource locations where they get fed or where they rest or whatever in a way that we think does recreate much of how animals use habitat in the wild.
I'm thinking about these bridges and these big cats walking over them, walking over your visitors. That just seems like a formula for a potential accident. I mean, so I'm thinking more of the cat box kind of accident.
So wherever we have primates crossing the public space, we do have sort of a protective structure underneath the trail so that we don't have that kind of thing happen. With the big cats, we're not doing the same thing. So far, we've not seen any issues with that, and we're prepared to address it if it does happen.
What does that mean?
everything from we've got T-shirts to replace any clothing that might get wet, as well as, sort of cleaning supplies and so on. So we're prepared to address it. We've had cats kind of going over visitor space on a very small scale inside Big Cat Falls for a number of years, and this has not been an issue.
Huh. Well, I think we all just learned how to get a free T-shirt at the Philly Zoo. But it sounds like you might have to wait around for that to happen. What kind of reaction are you getting from the public?
It's really fun to watch. Anecdotally, as I said, this perspective is so different, and people engage in a very different way. Even with the primates, we've seen that people immediately get what we're trying to do. We're creating opportunities for animals to play and travel through the trees and move long distances, and people seem to instinctively get that. The big cats, I think it's a reaction of when you see that tiger over your head, it's just jaw-dropping. Even for some of our longtime staff and volunteers, I saw more than one tear in an eye because it is just so stunning to see and so rewarding to see how the cats are using it and seem to be enjoying it.
Wow. Andy Baker is Chief Operating Officer at the Philadelphia Zoo. Thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Jeff.
We're talking about zoos this hour on Radio Times, and next we're going to discuss some of the challenges that zoos face. We'll have history professor Jeffrey Heisen of St. Joseph's University and Meredith Bayshaw, a psychology professor at Franklin and Marshall College. They'll be here in the studio with us. You can join the discussion at 1-888-477-9499 or send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be back after a break.
Supporting WHYY, the Exit Zero International Jazz Festival in Cape May, New Jersey, May 30th through June 1st. The Cape May Convention Hall and 6 club venues will feature jazz performances by Dee Dee Bridgewater, the Roy Hargrove Quintet, and A Night in New Orleans with the Dirty Dozen Brass Band and Kermit Ruffins. Other highlights include Jazz at the Estate, South Jersey Vineyards, and more. Tickets, reservations, and info at ExitZeroJazzFest.com or 609-849-9202.
Thanks to close to 5,000 of you who chose to support WHYY during the recent Spring FM membership campaign. This is Ed Cunningham. Every pledge that comes in, whether by phone or by web, makes WHYY a strong service. We'll invest your dollars right back into the programming you expect from us. Whether you're listening to election coverage or calling in during Radio Times, you know that as a member, you helped make this service possible. Thank you for your support.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Senator Mitch McConnell is one of the leading Republican voices on Capitol Hill, but he has high disapproval ratings at home in Kentucky. What will that mean when he faces a challenger in Tuesday's primary? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're talking about zoos this hour on Radio Times. With me here in the studio is Meredith Bashaw. She's an associate professor of psychology at Franklin and Marshall College. She studies animal behavior, and her research centers on social relationships and the welfare of captive animals. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also here in the studio is Jeffrey Heisen. He's an assistant professor of history at St. Joseph's University, and he's currently working on a book about the cultural history of American zoos. Welcome to Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
So this series of trails at the Philadelphia Zoo has been building. Projects like this it looks like they're a trend happening among zoos, right? There's kind of a change going on over time from the old days of kind of bars and tiles to something different. Tell me about that.
There certainly has been a very complex and rich history of exhibit design. I think it is fair to say that there's been a shift over the last generation from more artificial enclosures to more naturalistic, from exhibits that were built primarily to show the animals to, as Andy Baker suggested, exhibits that are meant to enrich the captive lives of the animals. What's fascinating to me about the trail system at Philly is that you have exhibits that actually aren't all that naturalistic, and yet the behaviors that are encouraged are, as he suggested, behaviors that they might be doing in the wild. And so in that way, even though the frame may be less naturalistic than recent trends, the experience of the animals and ideally the experience of the visitors is a little bit more "quote unquote" wild,
and so Meredith Bashaw, could that be that for us a more naturalistic environment might be that there's a palm tree over in the corner, but for the animal a more natural environment might be that they have to go somewhere to find their food or something like that?
Sure, absolutely. So for an animal, it's all about what the environment does, what its function is. So the animal doesn't necessarily perceive things primarily visually like people do. So if you think, for example, about tigers, we were talking about the big cat trail, tigers are going to perceive things more in an auditory and a scent-based capacity than they are through their eyes. And so just making something look like their wild habitat doesn't necessarily do it for the tiger.
Huh. And so projects like this, where they're building trails all over the zoo and other zoos around the world, really, trying to create more natural environments, is there some science here that they're all working off of?
Sure. So zoo design is both kind of a science and an art,
okay,
right? And also a cultural construction, as I'm sure we'll talk about. So there's definitely science about the kinds of things that animals need, particularly in the case of primates and big cats. So it's no surprise that that's where the treetop trails has started, right, with primates and big cats, because primates are behaviors that you see in primates can kind of be, you can naturally infer their causes from things like things that humans do. You can't do that perfectly, of course, and you wouldn't want to anthropomorphize by pretending that they were little people with fur running around. But a lot of their needs are similar to ours, and a lot of their sensory perception is similar to ours. So that was kind of an easy bridge to start on thinking about what we might need to give good care to animals. And then carnivores do a bunch of very obvious, I'm sure you've seen lions and tigers pacing in the zoo, right? They do a bunch of very obvious behaviors when their needs aren't being met. And so it's easy to see those behaviors and to try to implement changes to reduce them. And so a lot of these elements like exploration, like the opportunity to interact with toys as though they were prey, the opportunity to get food in sort of more, you know, not just a packet of ground beef, but on the bone or a more natural form to chew on, those things are going to decrease some of these measures of, for lack of a better word, unhappiness in big cats.
Huh. And so it's not really this sort of black and white, you know, it's either natural and good or it's unnatural and bad, but it sounds like there's sort of this continuum.
Yeah, it's definitely a continuum.
No, please finish.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that one of the real challenges in the way we're thinking about zoos these days is to rethink what we mean by wild. And this has to do both with exhibit design and with the nature of the animals themselves. I think zoos have done a great job over the past generation or so of educating visitors to say animals will be, for lack of a better word, happier in more naturalistic settings. And when you have something that is slightly less naturalistic, that can become a little bit of a challenge from a promotional point of view, if nothing else. But then there's also the question of, well, are the behaviors of these animals truly like they would be in the wild? And then you start getting into these very complicated questions of, well, what is that animal in a zoo? Is it really a wild animal? Is it an ambassador of its species? Does it know what's naturally expected of a wild version of that creature? And that becomes both a real scientific challenge, but I think it also becomes a cultural and even sometimes philosophical challenge to define what exactly wildness is in the landscape and the experience of a zoo.
These are really big questions about zoos. And most of us, when we think about the zoo, we just think about having a fun time with our family. But there's a lot going on here about zoos. And you're welcome to call in, and we have a couple of really good experts here in the studio who can answer your questions. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number is 1-888-477-9499. The email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, and on Twitter, the handle is WHYY Radio Times. So, Jeffrey Heisen, this change from kind of what we all know of zoos to be in the past to looking more natural, being more natural, where does the pressure for that change come from?
It's from several different sources. I think part of it is the culture. You began to get, for example, in the post-World War II period, color television, color nature documentaries, more images that people had of what wild nature and wild animals looked like. And that becomes a different frame, a different set of expectations that people started bringing with them. You also had in the 60s and the 70s the emergence of the environmental movement, as well as the emergence of an animal rights movement that was much more intense in its concerns about zoos than the animal welfare movement had been for 100 years before then. And so I think there is a push from external sources, but there's also a movement from within, a recognition, as Andy Baker talked about and as Meredith talked about, that the quality of life for the animals, both in terms of their day-to-day existence and also in terms of potential success of captive breeding, especially of endangered species, that those experiences of the animals could perhaps be more full in a more quote-unquote naturalistic setting.
And Meredith, you visit a lot of, well, you both visit a lot of zoos for your work. Do you get a sense when you talk to people who manage zoos that this concern, this public concern that is out there, that they really take that in? I mean, they're really trying hard to find the ways to create a better environment for their animals?
I think that's absolutely true. I think we should be a little bit clearer that there's in the U.S. a sort of governing body called the Association of Zoos and Aquariums that's self-directed based out of the zoo community, and zoos can apply to that body to be accredited. And that involves a five-year visit by a panel of experts, or visit by a panel of experts every 5 years. They don't stay 5 years. They don't like you quite that much.
But I suppose if you like being in a zoo.
Yeah, need new ideas? No, but a visit by a panel of experts every 5 years, and they assess everything from, you know, enrichment and training and how the animals are cared for, to how the zoo's finances are run, to how their membership base is. So zoos that sort of volunteer to undergo that kind of scrutiny are perhaps more consistent. ASIA zoos are perhaps more consistent. And then there are a set of zoos in the U.S. that don't volunteer to undergo that scrutiny. And some of those maybe don't care as much for the welfare of their animals. And others are places where they see themselves more as rehabilitation kinds of facilities for animals that are injured in the wild. And they aren't interested in grabbing on to the sort of ASIA motto of recreation, education, conservation, and research as themes.
And we already have a phone call, and they're bringing up a topic that I plan to talk about a little bit later in the program, but let's go ahead and get into it now. And I think all I have to do is say the Copenhagen Zoo.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So for our listeners who aren't already aware of this, the Copenhagen Zoo in Denmark has, they've been in the news a few months back. The zoo shot a healthy giraffe and then slaughtered it and fed it to other animals. The zoo was trying to prevent inbreeding, and it's been very controversial. People calling and wanting the zoo to be closed down. And we have Janet calling us from Wincote here in Pennsylvania, and you have a question related to that situation, Janet.
Yes, good morning, and pleasure to talk with these experts from our Philadelphia Zoo. But my question really was that this was clearly a sentient creature, a healthy giraffe. It was fed its favorite breakfast. It had relationships with its zookeepers and I think with the public that attended it. It had been in captivity, you know, for purposes of being at the zoo. And what is your view of this situation?
Who wants to take that on? You want to start, Meredith?
I can start. I think it's a little bit more complicated than it's been portrayed broadly. So there's two things that I think weigh into this. One is that most breeding in zoos now, we talked about the AZA a minute ago, most breeding in zoos is sort of planned nationally because there's now, zoos are expected to be able to care for an animal over its entire lifetimes, right? So it's now considered, in a way that it wasn't before, irresponsible to produce an animal that you don't have a plan for, right? That there's not a space in your zoo or someone else's zoo for that animal to live out its days, and that's particularly a problem for long-lived animals. On the other hand, we talked about maybe some tensions between what zoo visitors and animals expect, right? Zoo visitors love baby animals, love them. and so zoos, of course, experience some push to produce baby animals as often as they reasonably can. Now, clearly, if you know in 10 months that that baby animal is not going to meet a good fate, maybe that's not the best plan. But there's a third layer here, too, which is, as it turns out, birth control for animals is tricky, right? So we're used to birth control for humans where, you know, you can take the woman can take the pill every day or can get a Norplant injection or something like that. And birth control for animals looks very similar. You get a daily pill or you get an implant placed under your skin that gives off hormones. And these things very effectively prevent conception, but we're learning that particularly in the cases of lions and giraffe, as they are working with in Copenhagen, those are not very reversible. So if I put an animal on contraceptives in their early in their life, they may never be available for breeding again. And we're also learning with things like elephants that if they don't breed early enough, then they may develop some reproductive pathologies or they may never be able to breed later on. So there seems to be kind of a critical period in early adulthood where they have to give birth in order to ever be successful. So if you want to maintain genetics, then you need all of these animals to be able to breed. But then how do you prevent them from breeding or do you need them to breed right away? It's a little dicey.
Yeah, Jeff, the Copenhagen has just kind of stepped right in the middle of that debate over and some of these tensions, right?
Well, I think one of the other aspects of the Copenhagen case that got lost in the media frenzy was that there are strikingly different ideas about how to manage captive populations among many European zoos versus American zoos. American zoos, as Meredith suggested, tend to favor birth control methods whenever possible. European zoos, particularly at Copenhagen, there was some discussion of how they believe that in order for an animal to develop fully, to have all of the experiences that a captive animal deserves, breeding is one of those, and that it would be inhumane to deprive it of that, though then, of course, there is potentially the inhumanity of culling that animal if, in fact, there's problems with inbreeding in the future. To me, and again, obviously coming at this from the perspective of a cultural historian, what was most fascinating about the debate over Marius the giraffe, the Copenhagen Zoo, is how incredibly tone-deaf the people at the Copenhagen Zoo and, to be frank, at the European Association of Zoos and Aquariums were in trying to defend what happened. They made all of these very compelling science and conservation arguments. They insisted that their model of controlling population was just as valid as one built around birth control. But then they started pushing back at what they called the sentimentalism of the public. Started saying that a giraffe is not a pet. It's not like a pet or a cat or a dog that you take home with you. It's not a pet. It's a wild animal. And my response to that would be, well, you gave it a name. You want people to come in to look at the adorable babies. The reason that zoos exist, the reason they're successful, is because of feelings. It's because of sentiment. It's because, in some ways, people look at zoo animals as public pets. And that's their blessing and their curse. And I think the situation at Copenhagen Zoo really crystallized that contradiction for a lot of people.
And I wonder, we're talking about a giraffe here, but what if we were talking about a snake?
Yep. And I think that's a really important point. I actually, the weekend that the news broke about Marius, I was at a conference about human-animal relations in history, and we talked about exactly this question of where on the sliding scale of charisma among zoo animals, would an animal have to fall before you would start being okay with the idea of culling? And snake seemed low enough, but somewhere further up, I'm not really sure. And if it didn't have a name, would that also have made a difference? The sense that there are personalities, celebrities at a zoo is, again, one of the reasons why they work, why they succeed. But when that animal dies, especially if it dies under either tragic circumstances of malpractice or under a even more dramatic situation like this, then suddenly that celebrity comes back to bite the zoo.
And Meredith, this idea that the Copenhagen Zoo responded scientifically but not emotionally, I mean, that's another tension we're talking about here.
Certainly it is. And there has always been a tension there's always been a tension in communicating science to the public. Scientists tend to want to provide 18 caveats for every finding. And that's because in science, right, the process of getting rid of those caveats, right, of working through in what cases does this theory actually apply is an important part of the process, but not something that the public necessarily wants to work through with you.
Yeah. Well, and people attend zoos for different reasons, and there's a lot of different tensions here that we're talking about, and we're going to spend the next 20 minutes talking about them. We'd like to have you join our conversation, though. The phone number here is 1-888-477-9499. The email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, and on Twitter, our handle is WHYY Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady. I'm filling in for Marty Moskowain, and here in the studio, we have Meredith Bayshaw. She's from Franklin and Marshall College, and Jeffrey Heisen from St. Joseph's University. They spend a lot of time thinking about some of these tensions that most of us just don't think about. We just go to the zoo. So call with your questions. Again, that telephone number, 1-888-477-9499. And we did get a tweet from Laura. She said, could we talk a little bit about the role of the collection and exhibit design? We talked a little bit about that, Meredith. The design is not just sort of what it looks like to us, but it's what it looks like to the animal.
Sure, and I think there's a lot of good research that goes into making well-designed exhibits. There's also a big art form to it, right? So I can't count the number of times that I've done this big two-year research project, found this very important finding, for example, that giraffe have social relationships, that particular individuals are more likely to be found together or spend time together or interact than others, even all in the same social group. And I've told this to one of the animal keepers, and they've said, of course, right? Because even though they haven't spent 2 years collecting scientific data that's validated and objective, they know these animals, and they know the kinds of things that the animals need. All goes into exhibit design.
Our guests have spent a lot of time at zoos, learning from zoos, and you can join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be back after a break.
Natural Lands Trust supports WHYY and invites you to find yourself outside. With 42 nature preserves spanning eastern Pennsylvania and southern New Jersey, Natural Lands Trust is a getaway to nature. To learn more about preserves, upcoming events, and how your support can help save open space, natlands.org. That's natlands.org. Natural Lands Trust. Land for life.
Louis C.K.'s comedy about divorce, parenting, work, and sex often takes his audiences to uncomfortable places.
You feel a little sweat on the back of your neck when you get there, but if you stay there for a second, you can find something joyful and funny in it.
Louis C.K. talks about the new season of his FX series, Louis, on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Female soldiers represent 15% of the active military, and they're returning home in record numbers. These women are at much higher risk than their male soldiers for developing PTSD. Moreover, when they do return home, they're likely to be single parents supporting children. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, returning female soldiers. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moskowain here on Radio Times. We're talking about zoos and the challenges they face. We have in the studio Meredith Bashaw from Franklin and Marshall College and Jeffrey Heisen from St. Joseph's University. And one thing I want to discuss, we've talked about the animals' experience a little bit here, and I bet we're going to talk more about that. But let's talk about the visitor experience. What it's not just about sitting there looking at an animal, Jeff Heisen, but it's also zoos want to teach you something now.
Well, they want to, and I think one of the big questions has always been, do they? I like to say that I do think fundamentally people go to the zoo for the same reason now that they've gone for 150 years, to see exotic animals active and up close. The frame has changed, the expectations have changed, the cultural context has changed, but I think there's something almost hardwired into us that makes us want to have that nose-to-nose, species-to-species contact. Zoos have become much more intentional in their efforts at education over the past generation or two. What's the challenge is to figure out how to measure that education. Zoos can put up all of the text that they want, they can put on all the keeper programs they want. The problem is, I think, for a lot of visitors, when they walk into the zoo, they're not walking in to learn. They're walking in, as you were saying earlier, to have a nice day, to spend some time with their family. And if zoos can figure out a way to leverage that family experience, that emotional experience, by connecting visitors and animals, maybe from there they can build to something that's more at the level of what we think of as education. But for a couple decades now, zoos have really struggled to figure out what it is that they do in terms of education and how to measure its success.
And I guess part of that is even though a lot of zoos are nonprofits, they're also businesses. These are expensive operations to run, right, Meredith?
Yeah, definitely. Even the animal care expenses are quite considerable. And you're looking at an elephant that eats 200 pounds of food a day. Someone has to buy that.
Right. And so you need to be able to attract a lot of visitors to bring in the money to pay for that. Let's go to the telephone. We have Molly from Langhorne, Pennsylvania. Molly, you're on Radio Times.
Hi. So my question is about how weather affects zoo animals. You talked about how trying to get a natural environment as possible. But I think this past winter has been especially rough on everyone, so I was wondering how it affected more exotic animals that aren't used to things like snow or heavy rains.
Meredith, that sounds like a good question for you.
Sure. So most animals are used to being outside without clothes on and are therefore relatively hardy to changes in weather, particularly things like rain. They do have some I'm going to say, weird and interesting behavior. So when I used to observe giraffe in San Diego, whenever it rained fairly hard, they would all go stand in the stream in the middle of the exhibit. I have no idea why. And they never did it at any other time. But so certainly there are weather effects on animal behavior. And that said, you know, days when you wouldn't normally think about going to the zoo because it's raining are a great time to go to the zoo and not have very many other visitors and see some cool stuff. In terms of extreme cold and snow, I am under the impression that the polar bears were having a blast over the past year. Certainly more tropical animals like the tigers are going to have a minimum temperature at which they have access to the outdoors, right? So some other places I've worked, if it's below 40 or 45 or 50 degrees outside, then the animals are going to be restricted to their cozy indoor quarters or at least have access in and out. So they might be able to choose to go outside and experience the cold weather, but come back in if their whiskers get a bit frostbitten.
And I think one of the interesting things that's happened over the last, generation or so, is that zoos in more northern climates have begun to think about their animal collections in terms of, are there animals for whom our weather just isn't appropriate? no matter how good the indoor exhibit is, no matter how cleverly we hide heating coils inside the external exhibits, we need to make choices. And so that is the responsible thing to do, but getting back to an earlier point, that can be a challenge if you now say we're not going to have elephants or giraffes or other animals that are used to warmer temperatures at our zoo because of our weather. That's going to have an impact on visitors. And what you've done for the sake of the animals may, in an ironic way, undermine your effort to enhance their lives through conservation and research because you're not getting enough people in the door.
And Meredith, a lot of zoos have decided not to have elephants anymore. Why are zoos choosing not to have elephants?
Sure. So I think the case of elephants is an interesting one. And I haven't done a lot of research on this particularly myself, but I know there are some very large studies commissioned by the British and Irish Association of Zoos and Aquariums and RAZA to look at
What was that last?
RAZA, Association of Zoos and Aquariums.
Okay.
To look at what exactly elephants need in a habitat, right? And so so these are studies that are looking at both how elephants act and interact in their captive environments in zoos and how they act and interact in the wild, and trying to see if there are important differences between those two. And then some zoos, for example, Philadelphia, have looked at that data and said, you know, given our current exhibit structure, given that we have this very old building and a relatively small space in the middle of a city, we can't dedicate enough space to elephants right now in order for us to house them responsibly. Mm-hmm.
And I just think one of the challenges that zoos are facing now is they're making these absolutely crucial and very justified decisions is, I think, in the back of the heads of many zoo folks is a fear of the slippery slope. If we are acknowledging that our zoo is not a good place for elephants, what are we going to do when we start getting pressure for polar bears or big cats or some other animals? And so one context that we haven't touched on a whole lot is the pressure from animal rights organizations saying, not just objecting to the particular care and welfare of this individual species, but objecting to the institution as a whole. And I think there's some fear in the zoo industry that as appropriate as these changes are in terms of choices of particular species that you should or should not exhibit, it could be seen as a sign of weakness or an admission of the ethical dilemmas of the institution as a whole.
Let's go back to the telephone. We have Naoki from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, it's Anoka, and I'm Cherokee. And I think one of the reasons that maybe people forget have this connect with animals is that for Native Americans, animals walk as a people, so they have a spirit. And I think if you realize that the reason they're oppressed is because you've broken their spirit. It's like as if you were to take your own parent and put him in the nursing home. You can actually see their spirit break. That's the cause of depression because it's not their natural habitat. So I think that's the biggest disconnect that a lot of Western societies should probably focus on is the actual spirit of the animal.
Well, here's another.
But the actual spirit.
Yeah, here's another tension that a lot of zoos are going to have to face. Opinions like this.
I think there is a real difficulty at zoos with this question of natural habitat. I think that the caller is absolutely onto something, that there is something in the nature of the animal that is changed by living in a zoo exhibit as opposed to living in the wild. But I also think it's important to remember that for the vast majority of zoo animals, especially mammals, they don't know from the wild. They don't know from nature. They were born into captivity. And so there's a real challenge in trying to determine, well, what is natural for that animal? Is it really missing home if the only home it's known is captivity?
And Meredith, you study the behavior of animals. How do you sort of determine what a particular animal considers home anymore?
So you look at things like what that animal interacts with given the opportunity, what sorts of types of spaces and environment it prefers to stay in. there's a really, this is not a zoo study, but there's a really interesting study George Mason and colleagues did with mink a few years back where they actually put a mink in a farmed mink in a pen and connected it to a bunch of other pens with a bunch of resources, like a pool to swim in and a nest box. And they trained the mink where all these, they let the mink just freely explore all these things so it knew where everything was. And then they started putting weights on the doors and they looked at how much weight the mink was willing to push to get into some of these particular resources. And they found something surprising, like the mink really wanted access to a pool, even though it only spent 5 minutes a day in there. It was willing to push a really heavy door to get to a pool and not as heavy a door to get to a nest box, because it turns out, you know, if it's going to be a lot of work for me to get to my nest box, I'm just going to curl up in the corner of my box.
Wow, very interesting. Let's go back to the telephone here, and I think we are going to Clark in Queen Village. Clark, you are on Radio Times.
Yeah, I always had a problem with zoos, and you guys are touching on it now. That isn't it unfair to take an animal out of his natural environment for our own entertainment and curiosity?
Meredith?
I mean, I think there are two questions of fairness, maybe. It may be unfair to that individual animal. Most zoos will tell you they're going to do the best job that they can to take care of those animals. And as Jeff pointed out, those are animals that were born in captivity. So in very rare cases, especially for mammals, now we're hardly ever bringing animals in from the wild. It's mostly zoos are mostly using animals that have been bred in captivity. That's not as true for fish and reptiles, which we could talk about later if you'd like. But I lost my thread. Where was I going with that?
Yeah, so let's go back to
the second unfairness.
The second unfairness. Yeah. So it might be unfair to the individuals, but one of the reasons that zoos are framing themselves in terms of education and research and conservation now is that perhaps by being unfair to a few individuals, if you think having them in captivity is unfair, they can be producing broader benefits for their conspecifics, their other members of that animal species in the wild.
And this is, again, where I think the challenge between the public view and the scientific view really clash, because, of course, the reason that people go to zoos, they don't go to see species, they go to see individual animals. They go to see species in the sense of, I personally love red pandas. I will go to any zoo in the world to go look at the red pandas. But there is a personality, right? There is an individuality in the animals with whom we interact in the zoos, and the most famous of them at individual zoos, we give names and we have birthday parties for them and we have naming contests when they have babies. And so even though in a intellectual sense we might understand the idea that it is fair and good and just for the species as a whole that these particular individuals are kept in captivity, if we are uneasy with the experience that we see or project onto that individual, then we're uneasy and we see the whole situation as unfair for the entire institution, for the entire species.
We have plenty of listeners who want to get in on the conversation here. Let's go to the telephone and Nancy in North Philly. Nancy, you are on Radio Times.
Well, thank you very much. And before I ask my question, I would like to say I'm a Philadelphian living, but I was actually born in New York City, so the Bronx Zoo reminds me that it would be an ideal place for what you folks are talking about if it's not already taking place. And Philadelphia Zoo is one of my favorite places. So, but let me give you my question. What is the probability that there could be a dialogue started between the zoo and animal control in the city about how to go about sterilizing feral cats? I know this is a stretch, but I mean, I'm sure you folks have a concept of how to keep the birth rates down, and I don't know if your information could help in any way. So
okay.
I'm going to leave it there, and thank you.
Meredith can answer your question there.
Sure. So this doesn't so much come from the zoo, but there is really good research on sterilizing feral cats and that sort of program, and the thing that seems to be most effective there is bringing the cats in from catching the cats where they are, bringing them in and spaying or neutering them, and then putting them back. Because if you don't put them back, then the remaining cats tend to breed faster and produce more feral cats. So it seems like what they call spay and replace programs are the most effective way to deal with feral cats. And that has come a little bit out of zoos, although zoos are usually more worried about eventually being able to breed that animal again, whereas for feral cats, we're probably more worried about, we're perfectly happy with that animal never breeding again.
We're learning all kinds of new things here on Radio Times today. We got a tweet that came in asking the question, are zoos boarding zoo animals to control populations? Do we know if they're are abortions occurring in zoos to control populations?
I am not aware of any abortions in zoos.
Okay, so it's more the
yeah, it tends to be either physical or chemical contraception up front to prevent pregnancy or great celebration that pregnancy has occurred.
And again, I think one of the things that happens here when we talk about birth control or abortion or other means of controlling populations, we are caught in that species versus individual tension, right? We talk about what's good for a species as a whole, but then we may be uneasy with what that means for an individual creature. And I think Meredith used the term earlier, anthropomorphism comes in here, the projection of human feeling, human identity onto animals. When we talk about something as personal as birth, that becomes even more fraught with tension.
And it's different. The choices we make are different based on where we are. I mean, we brought up the situation with the Copenhagen Zoo. I mean, the decision they made there would just never be made here. Is that right?
I think there's a decision that's been made by the American AZA that's, again, different than what's going on in Europe. Some of that is about science, but I do think some of it is about the public vision of what these institutions are. And like it or not, I think AZA has very smartly recognized that there needs to be a comfort, a public comfort with how animals' populations are controlled that, for better or worse, EAZA, European AZA, didn't think about when they started developing policies that are based more around culling.
Well, thank you both so much for being here. You've taught me certainly that going to the zoo is a lot more complicated than I thought it was a week ago. Jeffrey Heisen is an assistant professor of history at St. Joseph's University. He's currently writing A Cultural History of American Zoos. Meredith Bashaw is associate professor of psychology at Franklin and Marshall College. She studies the social relationships of giraffes and is currently working on reptile enrichment at zoos. Boy, that sounds like a whole other show, I'm sure. If you'd like to learn more about this program, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You'll find links to our Twitter handle, our Facebook feed is there, and there's information on podcasts. The engineer today is Adam Staniszewski, and the producers of Radio Times are Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Bilder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moskowain.